The first true retrofit, as opposed to renovation, was Mashpee Commons by DPZ, which I already showed. But the most influential has been Meisner Park by Cooper Terry. It was developed as a public-private partnership. The city was faced with spreading blight from a dead mall, shown in the upper left, and then it used tax increment financing towards redevelopment. The city established a redevelopment agency, who then hired a private developer. They knew that a regular mall had already failed on the site. They weren't going to just try to redo that. So they instead pioneered a lifestyle center, which this was early on for lifestyle centers, with open-air shops facing a lushly landscaped boulevard, lots of restaurants, and with residents and office workers above them to help support the restaurants. Now, I assume everyone here knows what a lifestyle center is. Open-air shopping center, generally upscale, and the biggest difference between a lifestyle center and a mall is the number of restaurants. And the reason behind the number of restaurants is really, you know, there's just several, but one is certainly to attract the so-called creative class, to provide venues for power lunches and networking. And it's really reflective of the demographic shift in the suburbs away from being principally family-oriented, where everybody eats at home or at a fast food joint, to becoming that much more urban, that much more oriented to singles and professionals. The fact that we're seeing so many more restaurants coming into the suburbs. So lifestyle centers were very new when Meisner Park was built, and it upped the ante by also adding residences. In that way, it built in a clientele. And it's been extremely successful. In the second phase, they added luxury condos. They only started with apartments. They didn't know how successful it would be. They've also included two museums and a concert hall as great civic anchors. It's now the city's second largest taxpayer and routinely considered its downtown. The project does not have great connectivity, and that's its biggest sort of flaw. The boulevard is not a boulevard that goes anywhere. It's sort of just a linear park in the middle of the project. But it has nonetheless spurred more neighboring redevelopment and demonstrated both the economic and social value of public investment in public space. Meisner Park has inspired an even larger scale dead mall to downtown retrofit in Lakewood, Colorado. Bel Mar is another public-private project building 22 urban blocks on the 103-acre site of the failed Villa Italia Mall. The plan provides very good connectivity with adjacent neighborhoods, several small parks, an ice rink, and walkable streets. It's got a nice range of housing types, from flats to lofts to mews and duplexes. It even has an urban wind farm to power kiosks and parking meters on the one parking lot in the project. It combines a little bit. These are the two sort of main arterial roads that it's at the corner of. And this much of the project is pretty standard strip mall with a big parking lot. The rest of it is really very urban perimeter block kind of building. But this is where then they take the existing, where they got the conventional parking lot is also where the light standards all have wind turbines and actually are generating power to try to use the fact that that's going to be the big open space actually towards a somewhat more sustainable version of a parking lot. Bel Mar has done very well so far and is only half built out. The site will be within a 15-minute walk of Denver's new transit system, and the city has also conducted a corridor redevelopment study aimed at improving walkability along the rest of its commercial strips. So it's having the kind of trigger impacts that are great. The city's active role in the project recognizes that Lakewood has matured into the fourth largest municipality in the state, and thus its identity is now better served as a downtown than by a mall. But that was a real struggle for Lakewood. Lakewood initially did not want a quote-unquote downtown. They didn't think they needed one, they didn't think that was who they were, but they had this dead mall, and they couldn't get anybody to fix their wall. And they very much embraced the downtown now, and it's become one of the most popular places and markets to live in that town. But it was a struggle. It was not what people thought they wanted at first. This shift in the identity of suburbs, I think is a very important trend. Many suburbs now house as much, if not more, commercial space than their central cities, upending the traditional core periphery model of the regional economy that the University of Chicago Planning School was so famous for. As they mature into becoming destinations, how to try to maximize it, the fact that it is sitting in this valley, and to try to frame views both from here to two key peaks of Mount Olympus, and the fact that this main corridor turns and comes down here, so to frame a view as you come up here to a tower, and then to also have that tower be on view then also in relation to the mountain. So the to really sort of make T5, transect level 5, for those new urbanist wants. The T5 in the center here, transitioning down to T3 as it meets the neighborhood, and sort of T4, whether that makes it residential along a new linear park along a daylit creek at the edge. So this has been a culverted creek now being turned into the new sort of urban edge. There's a lot of use of plum trees to recall the original orchard. The cinema is designed to maximize its potential civic role with a balcony and exits towards the sunset. A lot of sort of really rethinking of how to try to take the components of a mixed-use lifestyle center and make them really help to make this a more public space. The main street arcs through the site, very deliberately trying to make the site at the design as un-mall-like as possible. It's not the straight shot dumbbell. It's not about keeping consumers on their feet. It's about providing lots of places to sit, to explore, enjoy the views, public places. But at the same time in doing that, the retailers are very aware of making lots of exposed corners to improve merchandising, placement of stores to maximize internal visibility. Lots of also attention to this project is almost certainly going to go for LEED Silver. It might go, might aspire higher. Lots of attention to green strategies kind of throughout the site. And one of the other really interesting, I think, aspects of this project, a few more images, is that the developer, what's particularly promising here, is General Growth Properties. GGP, based in Chicago, is the second largest mall owner in the country. They are a REIT. And the fact that they are interested, that they're doing a retrofit like this, says something when the second largest mall owner in the country is going in this direction. This particular project is a very retail-driven retrofit. They see the housing and the office as basically ways to maximize the land value for them, but they're sort of amenities to the retail. They're principal, basically these guys are mall developers, they're principally concerned with the retail. But why they see those other uses as so key for them is because this is how they will differentiate this retail property from all of the other malls, especially at a time when the mall market is going down the tubes. The mall market is thoroughly saturated, and GGP knows it. The only way for REITs like GGP to grow is through acquisitions of other mall companies. When they bought Rouse in 2005, it meant that they found themselves owning competing malls in the same market. So what they are now doing, is to retrofit the weaker mall whenever they got two in the same market, into a much more mixed use. And Cottonwood Mall is their first test case of this. And so because they see that it's complementing. They're not completely getting rid of the old style malls that if they're still doing well. But they recognize that it's much more complicated to do this. It takes more time. It requires more community buy-in. But they're committed to doing it right, and it was pretty interesting to see. What was interesting also was to see that the biggest struggle, frankly, was over Whole Foods. As a committed, I have to admit, I shop a lot of Whole Foods. I do like Whole Foods. But to see what the power of a single retailer like Whole Foods has to make or break a project like this is actually really significant. Whole Foods will be flexible. If there's a market that they desperately want in, they will build underground or build above ground. But 99% of the time, they have other options. And so they will demand the surface parking lot. And so they did end up. This is the main, real main and main intersection. The original plan calls for the office to go around the corner and to wrap the Whole Foods with only with underground parking. This slide is flipped in orientation, but it's ended up now with surface parking at the intersection, which is a real loss, but with a trellis for farmers markets around the edge, and then at least a dual entry Whole Foods. The cafe will be on the main street. But it's just always interesting to see how which battles are won, which battles are lost, and quite why in all of these things. Now, it's not only dead or dying malls that are retrofitting. This one's a case of retrofitting around a thriving mall and business park. This is down in Dade County. The Dadeland Mall is the fourth best performing mall in the country. What happened was really, here's Dadeland Mall, an existing photograph, and then there's a small office park kind of over here, but in between is mostly car dealerships, very large underperforming asphalt plant. What happened with a regional plan that for transit, which changed the zoning, that said that once those transit stations go in, by right, density will be allowed to be a lot bigger right at these stops. So the new transit, one stop at this end, one stop at that end, led to then a plan, a rezoning, not just overlay, but a complete rezoning that called for much denser, called for wrapping the mall, installing a street grid, coming off of the mall's pedestrian system, integrating that with the office park, and they expected this to be about a 25-year build-out. It's the condo, nobody knew that the condo boom would happen quite so quickly. They've gotten several 25-story buildings, a lot of 8-story stuff, very much under construction. I imagine it's all slowed to a halt right now in the current market. A few things got grandfathered in. The strip mall got in just before. That land's going to be way too expensive to stay in that form for very long, even though it's brand new. It's very interesting to see kind of how these things are doing. This is also a DPC in Dover Cole organized the charrette that led to all of this. Kendall is also, I think, that this one project, Kendall, is a good case of looking at a publicly led project that works across multiple parcels. Most of the other projects that I've shown were really a single large parcel owned by a single developer. In multiple parcel projects, the codes and the master plan are necessarily a lot less stringent and a lot less fixed. Especially in Florida, the way Florida law would not allow the planners to dictate where open space would occur or it would have been considered a taking. Each parcel had to have up to, I think, 12% open space. But so what they were able to do was locate intersections where four parcels met or multiple parcels met, and they'd look at that point and they'd say, your open space has to touch this point. We can't shape it. But by at least identifying those points, they could assemble the open space into larger parcels. And it's actually worked out remarkably well. A few places where it's really odd, but it's in general worked remarkably well. And similarly, I think the architecture runs a real gamut. Some of the architecture in the project is very, very good, and some of it just is kind of high winch factor. But the connections to transit are surprisingly weak, which is really kind of strange, given that that was such the primary driver. Everyone's waiting to see whether the mall, the Simon property zone of that mall, they didn't take this thing seriously at all. They just didn't think it was really real. And then once they realize that, whoa, okay, now at this point it stands. If they want to do any renovation at all, they have to accept the fact that liners are coming. And so it'll be interesting to kind of watch how that one happens. So Kendall is almost really an example of an edge city because you've really got the mall and the office park, but it's quite not the only example of an edge city that is retrofitting. These are Addison Circle, Legacy Town Center, both outside of Dallas, both developed by Post Properties, and mostly with architecture mostly by RTKL, and some of the planning. And then at the bottom, Perimeter Place, one in Atlanta. These are all examples of sort of infill projects. They're not redevelopment in the same sense, but they're sort of infilling into existing edge cities and providing walkable town centers with restaurants, residences, and connections to transit in interesting ways. And they're all, I mean, the RTKL projects really sort of pioneered the development of what's now often referred to as the Texas donut, the parking garage that gets wrapped with housing. It's an interesting sort of hybrid type because it provides suburban parking ratios with urban streetscape. And, you know, is this really urbanism, or are we just sort of dressing it up to look like urbanism? You know, if people are still just as auto-dependent, we're providing just as many parking spaces as we ever did. There's sort of some talk about, well, in the future you could still build more housing up on top of the deck once if we could get down to the point where we don't need quite as many parking spaces per resident. They do also the Texas donut, because now it's the dimensions of the parking deck that determine the overall block size, you tend to get some very large, you can get very large, not so walkable blocks. But still, it's a much better alternative to the LA podium, I think, kind of a project that, and that integrate, recognizing that we at this point in time, we absolutely have to integrate parking into these projects. But it's just interesting, I think, to again look at what's happening. Century City in LA is, you know, one of the quintessential car-oriented environments of an edge city, and they're now figuring out how to overlay a whole pedestrian system, which was actually originally planned, but it was never built. Even back in the 60s, they had planned for pedestrian systems, but they never built them. Now they want to get residents in there. They want to put it. They're putting building condo towers, and now, you know, 40 years later, they're actually going through Tyson's Corner, which is sort of, you know, the edge city project. Is getting the DC Metro system is going in and about to insert TODs into Tyson's. So, you know, whether it'll be interesting to see how these plans are affected by the current, you know, collapse of the subprime housing market. Is this a different enough market of the suburbanites that want to live in more urban housing that this will not be so effective? We'll somewhat see. But I think there are good reasons to be very optimistic that there is a market and very strong support for all of this new density in the suburbs. I already mentioned just the simple fact of population growth. The other side of the fact of population growth is in the number of buildings that we're expected to be building. Estimates are that by 2030, half of the buildings in the U.S. will have been built since 2000. We've got a lot of buildings that we're building very fast, and currently, so kind of where we put them is going to be a big question. And what's driving this in particular is the rise in single households. And I think, you know, everyone's heard this story plenty by now. But even and especially in the suburbs, there are many suburbs now that actually have more single households than they have dual or family households. A lot of that's due to the aging population. Some of that is also due to the echo boomers. The echo boomers are almost as large as the baby boomers. They're just entering the housing market now, and they will be a huge population. They are the emergent creative class. As long as the jobs a lot of markets now, there's more jobs out in the suburbs than there are in the downtown. It's not like all of those echo boomers are going to be living in downtown condos. A lot of them are living out in suburban condos. And they really aren't, you know, all of the stories about the creative class, I mean, that they need to be, you know, they need to be in places where they can network, where they can look for mates, where they can, do all the sort of more things that urban situations often facilitate a little bit more.